Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Mayor Triple Threat was at the City Club yesterday. Amid all the noblemen and magistrates of Chicago, of course, for one of the... And, you know, and I take shots at the City Club, but once upon a time, the City Club was actually sort of a useful institution. I've given speeches at the City Club. I participated in debates at the City Club. This is back when Tom Roser was involved or Tom Donovan was involved, and there was actually interest in putting ideas side by side. There was actually interest in hearing from center-right voices. But those days have long since passed. That's the issue, and this is why I ridicule the City Club as I do, because it's just become another organ of the political class in the city, and how boring is that? Well, very boring. Mayor Triple Threat giving customary remarks. The only interesting part, of course, was what is au courant, which is things like CTA mask wearing. And, Amy?
Yes, sir.
You're trailing Triple Threat. So
the one press conference I missed, but basically she was just
Give us the upshot of what she had to say at this at City Club.
Oh, yeah. Everything's going to be fine. It's going to be the summer, not the summer of love, but the summer of joy.
Just wait till Memorial Day and our summer. It will be the summer of joy in Chicago.
Yay. After a Everything's going to be all better, right? The summer of joy in Chicago. But yeah, she she didn't make the big announcement that she's going to be running for re-election, but she wanted people to know that she knows that they feel afraid to come downtown and to live here, to actually live.
People feel scared in our city. They don't feel safe. It's a thing that we must focus on, and we do every single day.
It's the same old, empty words, empty promises. There's no change. There's no game plan to have the summer of joy that she's talking about. It's all a bunch of bull jive.
Do you follow Amy Jacobson on Twitter, Amy?
Do I follow? Yes, I follow myself on Twitter, yes.
Do you? Okay, because you tweeted out yesterday the Mark Weiermahler question about the mask mandate on CTA trains and buses.
Where is that? Yes, and I'm trying to find it.
Yeah, and essentially, she giggled about it and then said, probably going to move in the direction of making people who feel comfortable recommending that if they want to feel comfortable and wear masks, then please do so. And then, of course, admonishing people, please, please, please show some empathy and fellowship to those who are still wearing masks on the CTA or on in public spaces in Chicago, because she said, she for one will continue masking up in public spaces. When she's on a plane, you'll notice her for a lot of reasons, but one of them is because she's one of the people wearing masks.
But 2 months ago, she's the one who said, once we drop the mask mandate, do you feel safe? Oh, no, I'm still personally, Amy, going to wear a mask at restaurants. Well, she was in a restaurant. She was at Maggiano's. Was she still wearing a mask? No, because she's full of lies. And she does whatever the left wants her to do, basically. So her saying, yes, when I fly, I'm still going to wear a mask, is just another lie from Mayor Lightfoot.
Speaking of the CTA, do we have anybody who rides the CTA? Does anybody ride the CTA anymore that you know of? I don't know.
My kids do all the time.
Really? How has their experience been of late?
Well, I tell them, don't get involved when you see a fight, run away, don't try to save the day. People are still wearing masks. People are still wearing masks walking down the street alone. People are still wearing masks at school.
Okay, let's get beyond masks to life and death issues.
Yeah, life and death issues. It's pretty scary. They've been focusing on masks instead of focusing on safety.
How scary is it?
It's so scary that
Greg Hines at the anti-business business periodical called Crane Chicago Business is writing about it. It's so scary that one Congress being Chuy Garcia and one Sack of Durbin, senior senator, sent an open letter to the CTA president, some flunky named Dorval Carter Jr., noting the 17% increase in violent crime so far in 2022 as compared to 2021, which was not a peaceful year, you may recall. While we appreciate the efforts of both the CTA and Chicago Police, have recently made to increase passenger employee safety on trains and buses throughout the CTA's network, more needs to be done to protect CTA's frontline workers and passengers. Oh, you don't say. I think you're leaving some people out of this equation of the CTA and the Chicago Police Department. Don't you think there, Chuy and Dickie? When it comes to making the CTA safe, making the city safe, are you missing anybody? The CTA, the Chicago Police Department? How about the honoree at the City Club yesterday? How about a multi-time honoree of the City Club, one Kim Fox? She's the Cook County State's Attorney, in case you hadn't heard. And all that money coming from the feds, the Fed funny money, $1 trillion in federal infrastructure from which the CTA hopes to get hundreds of millions, requires local transit agents to establish a safety committee. Oh boy.
There you go, another committee. You love that word.
That's when you know things are going to get cleaned up on the CTA, when you get that safety committee and you get labor officials around the table to come to agreement on improved safety protocols. Oh, that's when things are going to get better. Greg Hines, no, the CTA isn't safe. Oh, the city's not safe. You know, the political press corps in Chicago, always the last to know, aren't they? That's why they're so much fun.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, or you can text us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm-hmm. She's going to continue wearing her masks.
Plane,
people are going to continue getting robbed. I mean, I would have to be in full Bernie Getz combat wear to get on the CTA. I mean, even if it was safe, I wouldn't take it. But I mean, in this environment,
no,
come
on. You're putting your life on the line. And they, you know, she and the CTA president trotted out there and, oh, we're hiring more people, but they're unarmed security guards who, you know, we had when Paul Vallis filled in for you. Paul Vallis is, you know, knows one of those security guards that was hired.
Uh-huh.
I do believe. And he said, oh.
Whose idiot cousin is that security guard?
I don't know. But he said there was trouble on the CTA and they ran. Those extra security guards that are unarmed ran away from the problem instead of to the problem.
Can we? What about those?
Because they're unarmed.
What about those traffic management aides? Can we repurpose them from mimicking traffic signals to the CTA? Wander around.
They're back, though, because, you know, the Cubs season is baseball's back. So there's, you know, wandering around the streets and wasting
taxpayer dollars. You know, at least if they were on CTA platforms, they could do their semaphore routines and provide some sort of entertainment while you're waiting to get mugged. Chris on the Dan Ryan. Hey, Chris. Chris on the Dan Ryan. Have you been shot? Chris.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Yes,
no.
Go ahead.
I'm in the car. I'm safe.
Oh, no, you're not.
Yeah,
not on the Dan Ryan.
I can drive fast enough. I'm good.
Okay.
Just a real quick question. The mask mandate, like Amy, like you said, people are still wearing masks all over the place. Metro's dropping all the mask mandates. It's a programming of the Illinois people, because basically what happens is that the Illinois people are like a beat dog. We just do what we are told, and we don't question why. That is the whole purpose behind it. And I am currently in the market to get another job to get the hell out of here. So I'm now getting my financial stuff straightened out, putting my house in the market. So, you know, I'm out of here, man. I don't know what else to say, guys.
Where are you going to go, Chris?
I am currently looking at either Texas, South Carolina, North Carolina, and even Montana at this point in time, because I'm just, if I have to dig a ditch in Iowa, I will dig a ditch in Iowa to get the hell out of this state.
Wow.
Hey, Kevin Costner could use another ranch hand at the Yellowstone if you want to go to Montana.
I will grow a beard and put a toupee on for that.
All right.
Well,
thanks,
I got to tell you, Dan, one of my friends, their son lives in Bozeman, Montana, and they're calling Bozeman, Bozangeles, because of all the people from California that are just buying homes. So if a home goes on the market, they won't even come and look at it. They'll call, offer $50,000, $100,000 more than the asking price because they want to get out of there. But they don't want them to bring their politics with them.
Yeah.
And in Utah, they wear T-shirts that say, "Don't California my Utah."
Right.
Because land is being bought so quickly by people from California.
Frank, Arlington Heights.
And now it's time for Walter's perspective. And I'm Bill Curtis for American Justice, right here on A&E.
Is that apropos of anything, or you just wanted to get your Bill Curtis impersonation out there?
Please,
well, you kind of reminded me, this about this city back in the day, when we had a city club. You were talking about how it used to be good.
Yeah.
Remember our news, when it used to be good, when we had Bill Curtis on it and Walter Jacobson and Tim Weigel, I know he passed away, Mark Giangreco and Harry Volk, back in the day when Chicago was a great place to live. Now we have to deal with this harpy as our mayor. It's horrible.
Thanks, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Not all of this radio business is glamorous. Sometimes you have to go, you have to put on your scoop hat and do a little sleuthing. You have to try and find CNN Plus. So that you can watch an interview of Chris Wallace and Jen Psaki in case she says something relevant on behalf of the administration.
Once I find News Nation, then I'm going to look for CNN Plus.
Yeah.
Still haven't found either.
So we watch these things so you don't have to. Jen Psaki.
Let it go, let it go, let it go. Oh, that's a good lung capacity there, Dan.
Sort of, dying out as she ends her tenure.
When is she leaving,
by the way?
That was sort
of metaphoric.
This has been a long goodbye, if you know what I mean, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's been forever.
We can't miss you if you don't leave. Right. Jen Psaki on with Chris Wallace to talk about the mask mandate on planes and trains and what the DOJ, well, I don't think Chris Wallace expected it, but she announced on his show what the DOJ intends to do about that injunction handed down by a federal district court judge in Florida.
The CDC has asked the Department of Justice to appeal this ruling. So they're going to do that. That's important for two reasons. One, because we think it's entirely reasonable as the Department of Justice for the CDC, the health and data experts, health experts, most importantly, in our administration to be able to have that time to evaluate, but also because they want to fight to ensure the CDC's the authority and ability to put in mandates in the future remains intact. We know there's going to be ups and downs in this pandemic. We're all ready for it to be over, but we want to ensure that our public health experts are able to take steps if needed in the future.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. The real takeaway from that has nothing to do with the injunction on the mask mandate and has everything to do with what she just said at the end, which is preserve the power of the administrative state to promulgate mandates where the actual executive and legislative branches just serve as rubber stamps for the unelected bureaucratic branch of government.
And that's exactly what Mayor Lightfoot's doing with these, vaccine mandates for first responders and city employees. Same exact thing. She knows it's not about public, but if it's about health and safety, this is all about power and control for the next one. When that comes, what is she going to have?
Yeah,
she can't get him jabbed now.
But with Lightfoot, at least that's the executive doing it and not just rubber stamping. I mean, I guess she does the sort of the same two-step where she rubber stamps the recommendation of her health experts. Dr. Awadi, who was her one-woman CDC. So I guess that is a pretty good parallel, actually. But that's the play here. Make sure that the bureaucratic managerial class, the men and women of always in government and along with some of the politicians, make sure that they can continue to impose their will and have politicians act as rubber stamps where they play this game that they've played for 2 years. They each cover the others behind, right? I'm relying on my public health experts, and the public health experts tell you, I'm just providing advice and counsel to your elected officials.
Yeah, in New York, they did not release, there's a mask mandate on all public transportation because cases are going up. Here's their governor.
We watched for variants, they come, and now we're starting to see cases and hospitalizations go up.
So they're not, you know, going to let go of the diaper on your face anytime soon.
There's something else, though, sorry, beyond this. The media manipulation. I mean, this is really interesting. This just awful reporter we've mentioned before at the New York Times, and there's a lot to choose from, I understand. Apoorva Mandavilli. Despite the reported cheers on airplanes, new poll finds 56% of Americans favor requiring people on planes, trains, and public transportation to wear masks, compared with 24% opposed and 20% who say they're neutral. So a majority of the country supports the mask mandate, except that poll that was done by the AP and dutifully
blasted
by the New York Times.
Everywhere yesterday.
Right. And it's phony.
Oh, really?
There's a good breakdown of it. I'm glad somebody did the work that I didn't have to do, so I can just build off of his work. But, yeah, this guy who tweets out at Statomatic did a nice job. He looked at the construction of the poll, which is what you always have to do. I mean, I've done a lot of polling. I'm not a pollster, but worked with pollsters for decades. So I have, you know, a baseline understanding of this. I can pass an econometrics course, so I have a baseline understanding. I'm not any statistical expert, but you understand that if the sample is corrupted, then so is the result.
Let me guess, did they poll people who never fly?
Well, you're, you know, in the neighborhood. The poll was conducted, first of all, 5 days prior to the court decision removing the mandate. And he notes, as we've seen for 2 years, people tend in aggregate to appear to support mandates before they're removed, but that shifts once the mandate disappears. So in order to honestly test what has occurred, you have to do it after it's occurred, right? Not 5 days prior. Number one. That is enough in and of itself to cast plenty of doubt. But something else, the poll mostly done online, some phone, 1,085 American adults, not registered voters or travelers, just adults.
Okay.
Of those adults, the poll reports a Dem plus 8 sampling bias, which is a fairly heavy Democrat skew in normal times, but even more so in a current climate where the generic ballot favors Republicans going into the midterms at present. So a better survey to get a more accurate reflection of public opinion now, which is the point of the survey, snapshot in time, would be to recognize where the partisan splits are now. He also adds this. I mean, there's so many infirmities with this poll. Checking the wording and sequencing of the poll, respondents were asked their opinion on mask requirements for people in several different settings, including travel. It appears likely that many may have answered this as a quiz for what is currently mandated, which would have been an easy error to make the way the questions were phrased and sequenced. Also important in surveying, the phrasing and the sequencing. On the demographics, another problem. The respondents are also skewed poorer than America as a whole. 28% reported household incomes under 30,000, whereas in America, only about 23% of the nation has incomes under 30,000. And of course, mostly higher incomes fly. Chris and Carrie, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. And I never put much weight into polls because I can run a poll and I know exactly who to call to get the answer I need. But, you know, let's keep people in masks. All it does is make people angry and hopefully switch from Democrat to Republican. Keep them in masks. Angry is good.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Chris.
Yeah, but every mainstream media yesterday used that poll and interviewed people. Like this crazy lady, Cynthia Lynch, who is an unvaccinated 14-month-old.
Since the mask mandate's lifted, I won't fly with her. It doesn't feel safe and it doesn't feel fair.
Then don't fly.
But here's the thing. This is suborning perjury by the D.C. press corps. And I know, you know, the shock of that is long ago worn off. But understand, this is not an accident. And it's not an accident by the Associated Press who commissioned this survey. If you know anything about polling, and if you have any integrity in actually searching for what the answer is right now, what is the snapshot in time? What is public opinion on a particular person or issue right now? Then you would go through this, and it's something I've done a lot, so I know a little bit about this. You would go through this and make sure that the demographics are representative of, in the sample, are representative of the population. That it makes sense, that you're getting an accurate picture. If you're looking for an accurate picture, they're not looking for an accurate picture. It has to be either just metaphysical incompetence at the Associated Press, which is possible, or how do we get to this number? We need a number that shows a majority of Americans still support the mask mandates on public transit. And how do we get there? And by the way, the pollster has to be in on it, because no pollster worth his salt would make the sort of errors that have been detailed in this survey. So you're hiring a unethical hired gun. You're unethical. You hire somebody who's unethical, and together you conspire to get to a number that you want. You put the Associated Press brand on it. All the other media outlets that are part of the D.C. press corps, all the ruling class House organs, put it on blast, and there you go. You're trying to continue to drive public opinion. We were right. The populace still supports us, and we'll do it in our time. I mean, I agree with Chris and Carrie that keep the masks on, because it's just going to engender more disaffection from the Democrat socialists. But by the same token, let's make sure we understand the frauds they're perpetrating. And this survey that was out yesterday is a fraud, straight up.
Such a fraud. I mean, but again, it's going to affect public policy. It's going to, you know, it's the precipitous to implement the DOJ to reverse the CDC's decision or the TSA's decision. And
well,
that's what's wrong.
Yeah, but the
Let
DOJ
have a choice.
Well, I understand CDC is impaneled the DOJ, but it doesn't mean that injunction is going to be lifted. And by the way, the mandate is not in effect. Just because they're appealing doesn't mean that changes the status of things at present. Pete in Milwaukee, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Say, as far as the masks go, if a person wants to wear a mask to the last day they draw their last breath, that's fine, as long as the regime doesn't make them do it. Everybody has their personal choice, but the government has no right to keep pushing this on people and keeping people afraid.
Thanks, Pete. Well, I mean, nobody disagrees with that. Tell me somebody who says you should not be allowed to wear a mask. No one says that. If you want to wear a mask, wear a mask. I don't care. The mandates and the running of people's lives goes in one direction. From the COVIDian to the reasonable. It doesn't go the other way.
I think people under 18 should not wear a mask at all if they're not sick. Even if they're sick,
kids. I'm not talking about minors. I'm not talking about minors. That's a family decision. I'm talking about adults who are in charge of their lives. By the way, speaking of kids and the fallout, because this isn't just about masks and continuing to saw sawdust on masks, it's continuing to get an assessment of the fallout from the last 2 years, including but not limited to the mask wearing. New York Times reporting Of course, this is like Fox Butterfield effect. They don't connect the dots. The chronically absent student.
Yeah. I want to hear this story.
At one middle school, more than 40% of the students have been chronically absent this year. Districts are going to great lengths offering gift cards, night classes to reach them. Chronic absence has skyrocketed during the pandemic, said the director of attendance work and works, a national group that promotes solutions to chronic absenteeism, which, of course, has been linked to weaker academic performance. I can certainly attest to that from my chronic absenteeism at law school. So what are they doing? They're doing the same thing they did to get you to take the jab. Gift cards, groceries. One school put on their marquee. Did you see this?
What?
Please come back. We will eat bugs if you do. Now they're doing like a truth or dare to get you back to school.
Oh, that's so sad. Yeah, there's kids that were lost that they're never going to find. Kids that have dropped out of high school. I mean, it's all going to come out. We have to be patient and wait. But yeah, that's a problem. Are they offering them free, amusement park tickets too?
That's
in there.
Lottery tickets. I mean, think of the marijuana, condoms. Who knows what the list of offerings will end up being. Chronic absenteeism, and to your point, these, and it's so interesting because the left's mantra, in part, and usually for more cash for these terrible K-12 school systems, the school, the neighborhood school, is the safe haven for a lot of kids in difficult family situations.
Oh, yeah.
And that's true to some extent. When the school actually operates as a safe haven, as opposed to how many of these schools operate. But they say that in one breath, and then they lock them out of it in the next breath. And as you say, they're lost. Think of the efforts that are put forward every year leading in and out of the Bud Billiken parade to get kids in schools on the west and south sides of Chicago because the average daily attendance drives their state support.
Right. They need you there on the first day, and then it's... I mean, they'd like to have you back, but they don't need to have you back.
Mm-hmm. Chronic absenteeism. So here we go. The underperforming are further, dare I say, can I borrow a word? Marginalized by the very people who run around talking about how they represent the marginalized. Bunch of scam artists. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and Matthew Dowd. Matthew Dowd. You've seen him on This Week, part of the round table, one of the round tableists on This Week.
Oh, yeah, he's a staple there.
Yeah. ABC News contributor for a long time now. Originally rolled out as a Republican. Well, that's changed. Why did people think he was a Republican? Well, because he was the chief strategist for Bush Cheney 2004.
Right.
He's a Republican political consultant. Here's a note, too. To make this a comparison resonate, political operatives are to candidates and parties what the bureaucracy is to elected officials. So you don't see them, you don't know who they are, and you underappreciate their influence on both individual candidates and the parties to which they allegedly affiliate. How about the Lincoln Project in the 2020 campaign? Headed by...
some pervert.
Yeah, John Weaver, McCain, Steve Schmidt, McCain, political consultants. Because the consultants, and I know because I was one, to some extent still am one, since I'm running a PAC. The candidates come and go. The consultants stick around often, and they develop relationships with the donor class. And if you have access to the donor class, then you have influence, don't you?
And then you have access to the media. Yeah.
So don't dismiss, oh, he's just a consultant or an operative so lightly, if you do. I'm not saying you do. We have a pretty sophisticated audience. I think a lot of people understand this. But Matthew Dowd is a wonderful case study. Matthew Dowd, Bush Cheney, 2004 chief strategist. Maybe you start to connect the dots about who some of these high-profile consultants have been over the last 20 years or plus 30 years, 40 years. I would include Karl Rove in that. And he's even a better example than Dowd in terms of influence. So think about that. Think about the people who came of age in the Reagan era and then came of influence in the W era, and track the changes in the Republican Party over that time period. Maybe not causation, but there's correlation there. I think about it the same way, put it in Illinois context. Think about those who came of age in the Thompson era in the 80s in Illinois, and then came of influence, really not so much Edgar, although a little bit Edgar, but really came of influence in George Ryan years and beyond, and what the trajectory of the Republican Party has been over that 40-year period in Illinois. Not that it was good in the Thompson era like it was good nationally in the Reagan era, because, of course, that was an example of Illinois zigging when the nation zagged, and as usual, we made the wrong move. So Matthew Dowd, this most recent case study, he's on an MSNBC panel talking about the culture war from the perspective of Democrats. Now he's a Democrat socialist political operative, and he's decrying Democrat socialists for allegedly, according to him, not fighting the culture war against the likes of Ron DeSantis. You know, you have a few people in a few states stand up and bring the fight the way DeSantis has to the left in Florida. And all of a sudden, Democrat socialists aren't doing enough because they're not used to opposition like this, like DeSantis is bringing against Disney, for example. So Dowd, and listen to the language he uses because it's instructive. Bush, Cheney, 2004 chief strategist. Well, in 2022, and it's happened before this, this is just the latest example of it. The we he talks about isn't we like me and my Republican Party friends. The we is me and my Democrat socialist friends.
And if the Democrats continue on a campaign, well, we're just going to ignore the culture war. We're just going to put them, not get, you know, have a conversation about guns and not have a conversation about marriage and not have a conversation about what, how our kids are getting pushed around in school and not have that. We're going to talk about these other issues. Then we lose.
If we're going to talk about this and not that, meaning him and Joe Biden and team. Good Republican. And Dowd is, he's right, but of course, as a professional prevaricator, he's being disingenuous. They're going to lose not because they're not fighting the culture war. They're going to lose because they can't win on matters of war and peace or economic security, particularly in this environment. And so they have to demagogue Republicans as racist, misogynist, transphobes, blah, 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 because that's the only path. The only path is to get people not thinking about and talking about their economic security and their physical security. You have to get them thinking about, are you going to let these mean old Republicans bully kids or marginalized communities? They have to try that flim-flammery because it's all they have. That's translating Matt Dowd into real people speak. And then Matt Dowd did this, which is my favorite. Let me just say this before you hear from Dowd.
Is this going to make my head spin?
Any sentence that begins with, if Jesus were alive today,
oh boy,
always ends badly. There is no way to finish that sentence effectively as serving as a spokesman for Jesus. But Matt Dowd is confident enough in his Christianity. He's a good Christian gentleman. You know how I know? Because he tells you all the time. So he feels very comfortable speaking for Jesus in a sense. But what he's really doing is decrying people of faith on the right.
And I have said this before, and I'll say it again. If Jesus Christ was alive today, he would be called a groomer. What? He would be called woke, and he would be called a socialist if he was alive today.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. If Jesus were alive today, he'd be called woke, socialist, and a groomer. Because that's the way the intolerant people of faith on the right treat others. That's his point. And he's building off of this speech from a Michigan state senator that has gone viral. Michigan State Senator Mallory McMorrow. She took to the floor of the Senate there up in
Lansing, yeah.
Michigan, yeah, to respond to a colleague of hers who suggested that her support for, you know, the sexualization of children through K through 12 curriculum and through pro-trans policies applied to children was grooming. And Senator Mallory McMorrow of Michigan.
Royal Oak, Michigan, to be exact. Yeah.
Yeah, she wrapped herself in her Christianity, too, just uh-oh, like Matthew Dowd.
My mom taught me at a very young age that Christianity and faith was about being part of a community, about recognizing our privilege and blessings and doing what we can to be of service to others, especially people who are marginalized, targeted, and who had less, often unfairly. I learned that service was far more important than performative nonsense like being seen in the same pew every Sunday or writing Christian in your Twitter bio and using that as a shield to target and marginalize already marginalized people.
Hmm. Well,
okay.
I mean, Senator McMorrow, just a point of order. Is attending Mass weekly and being a servant leader, are those two things mutually exclusive, or can you do both? Is that a choice that one has to make?
Sounds like somebody's not going to church. Yeah. If you ask me, Dan.
Yeah. That may be. You may be onto something.
I'm on you, lady, there.
By the way, marginalized populations.
Why is writing writing Christian on your Twitter bio marginalizing people?
Mm-hmm. You know, right. Senator McMorrow, like those on the left, they're aghast at that anyone would virtue signal anything. Oh, of course they are. Does she have a Ukrainian flag on her social media profile?
Enough probably. People are hanging them from their cars.
Marginalized people. Is this an example of a marginalized person? I want to know because these are the policies being promoted by the likes of Matthew Dowd and Senator Mallory McMorrow from Royal Oak, Michigan. It's been less than a year since New Jersey implemented a new policy that would allow biological male prisoners to be housed alongside women in women's prison facilities.
Oh, yeah.
And now two women incarcerated at the Edna Mahan Correctional Facility are pregnant.
They're going to have a baby.
27 biological males are housed in that prison in Clinton, New Jersey, and there are over 800 women there as well. So is that... That felon, that dude who impregnated the two women in the women's prison, is he one of those marginalized people that we're fighting for, Senator McMorrow?
27? Mr. Dowd? That's a lot. 27?
Well, by the way, we're doing the same in Illinois.
We are?
Yeah, we've talked about it. State Rep Tom Morrison was all over this a couple of years ago. Quietly, we've been doing the same things in Illinois. Of course we have. We're Illinois.
Right. And it's easier. I mean, life is easier in a woman's prison. That's why a lot of them are doing it. Well, and then they have access to women. I know that sounds crazy.
Certainly if you're straight and you're pretending to be a woman.
Yeah, and you can get a little there.
I mean, obviously, this guy in New Jersey, he figured, he watched MASH. He knows. He knows
Clinger.
How you do it.
Yeah. We got a stage five clinger.
Ron in Salem, Wisconsin.
Hey, guys. I came in the middle of that. I just heard that whoever it was said that Jesus would be woke. If Jesus would be woke, why don't these leftist liberals follow him now, and why do they attack people that do?
Well,
Christianity has become, associated with Trump and the Republican Party.
Ron, thanks for the call. They attack people as Christians. That's what Matthew Dowd and Senator McMurrow from Michigan are doing. They're saying they're the authentic Christian. You're not an authentic Christian because you're a hate monger. They're saying you're a hypocrite. We're a hypocrite. So that's what they're saying. It's funny. I don't recall. And Matthew Dowd, he does the positively anodyne, Jesus hung out with prostitutes and tax collectors.
Oh,
yeah,
I,
right. Thank you for
Free
that.
Mary Magdalene.
That introductory CCD class, Matt. I really appreciate it. Everything on the left is predicated on force. And, that's not my takeaway from Scripture. I mean, what is it? It's choosing, free to choose. It's choosing to do right, choosing to follow in the footsteps. I'm not so confident to speak for Jesus the way Matthew Dowd is, but I'm just giving my takeaway. So, that seems to me the good Christian leftist problem when they wrap themselves in their faith and suggest that people of faith on the right are hypocrites because of their alleged hate of people. Jesus was all about love and I'm all about love. You're all about sentimentality. That is not love. You are all about libertinism. That is not freedom. You are steeped in coercion. That is your first response to anything you would like to see done in this world, in society, is to force people at the point of a gun to do it. And you're going to lecture me on Christianity, Matthew Dowd and Senator McMurrow. Okay. By the way, Mallory McMurrow went on in her speechifying that has Matthew Dowd positively in love and others of the left sharing this as, striking a blow against the Christian right. She went on to tell everyone who she is. Take a listen.
So who am I? I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom who knows that the very notion that learning about slavery or redlining or systemic racism somehow means that children are being taught to feel bad or hate themselves because they are white is absolute nonsense. No child alive today is responsible for slavery. No one in this room is responsible for slavery. But each and every single one of us bears responsibility for writing the next chapter of history. Each and every single one of us decides what happens next and how we respond to history and the world around us. We are not responsible for the past. We also cannot change the past. We can't pretend that it didn't happen or deny people their very right to exist. I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom. I want my daughter to know that she is loved, supported, and seen for whoever she becomes. I want her to be curious, empathetic, and kind. People who are different are not the reason that our roads are in bad shape after decades of disinvestment, or that healthcare costs are too high, or that teachers are leaving the profession. I want every child in this state to feel seen, heard, and supported, not marginalized and targeted because they are not straight, white, and Christian. We cannot let hateful people tell you otherwise to scapegoat and deflect from the fact that they are not doing anything to fix the real issues that impact people's lives.
Can you feel the love?
Wow. Mom?
So she doesn't want people to be marginalized. She wants people to be seen and heard and respected for who they are. unless you're a straight white Christian on the right. Do I have that right, Senator McMurrow?
Because that's what it sounds like. Roads have to do it with anything.
Do I is that what that sounds like to you?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. You can also text us on our text line. It's fired up, ready to go, 646-36-DA, then a quick comment.
By the way, the I'm glad she identified herself as a straight, white, Christian, suburban mom of the left.
Twice.
Because
yeah.
Those are the worst people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a good example of who I'm talking about when I reference those denizens of Hinsdale Glen Ellen and Naperville and River Forest and the North Shore who fit right into the McMorrow mold.
Yeah, and I lived in Royal Oak, Michigan, and it's kind of like Hinsdale.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Of course it is. Keith in Kankakee.
Yeah, good morning. One of my biggest problems with the left using Christianity against us or calling us hypocrites is they forget that there has to be some morality. We can't just live like heathens unrepentantly. I think that's the message they always miss.
Yeah, good one. Good point, Keith. Thanks. John, Romeoville.
Yeah, if Matthew and Mallory were brought living in the time of Jesus, they would have been brought before him with a request to cast the demons out.
Thanks, John. George Moni.
Hey, Dan, as long as the prison babies grow up to vote Democrat, I don't see a problem.
Thanks, George. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We do another installment of a recurring issue, which is, what do we have to do to make women happy? Amy?
Just give us everything we want and leave us alone. We yes. want space and time to ourselves.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since 1971, according to studies that have attempted to measure this,
yes,
everyone has gotten more miserable. But the decline in women's overall happiness has outpaced men's. The happiness curve inverted sometime in the early 90s, according to research cited by Dan Gelertner in a piece in amgreatness.com. A little over a decade ago, he notes, there were researchers at Wharton Business School at Penn published a paper showing, despite women's increasing work and educational opportunities, their self-reported happiness was in steady decline. And again, as with men, back 50 years ago, women were on average happier than men. Now they're actually, everybody's more unhappy, but women are even more unhappy than men are unhappy.
You got that right, sister.
Yeah. The researchers couldn't explain, really, their observations of this trend in unhappiness.
Well, it's hard to measure happiness, isn't it?
Well, they measured it. Because, I mean, it's just public opinion surveys.
Okay.
But they couldn't really explain, couldn't pinpoint why. What were the one or two variables that had significantly changed that explained the increase in unhappiness? Maybe some of the ladies out there can tell us. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The Wharton researchers posited the hypothesis that happiness in the home, per 1970, has now become happiness in home and work in order to be happy, and the latter is more difficult to achieve, happiness at the workplace. And maybe that explains the increase in unhappiness between 70 and, say, 2010, about the time this paper was published, because of the significant increase in women in the workforce.
I could see that. I mean, back then, I don't think a lot of – well, I remember my mom worked in the 70s and the 80s, but it's stressful because being a stay-at-home mom, that is a job. So, essentially, you're doing two jobs.
Yeah, I think you're getting to something. Vox.com revisited this issue relatively recently, and they explained that it's the unhappiness among women, the increase in unhappiness among women, is because they're aware of persisting limitations on them imposed by men. So the persisting limitations on them imposed by men have become more pronounced over the last 50 years or less?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I'm not unhappy because I feel, you know, suppressed by men in the world.
Are you unhappy, Amy? Are you happy? I love that question. When people ask me that question, are you happy? I scoff.
What do you say? Buzz off.
I say, that is an absurd question. And I'm not answering it. I don't even know how to answer it.
I hate sometimes when people ask me, so how are you doing? You don't care how I'm doing.
No, it's just small talk. You're supposed to say fine and everybody moves on. No one actually wants you to tell them how you're doing.
Well, I got this rash on my backside.
Yeah, right. It's a polite bon mot. Don't tell me. Could not care less. So how you doing?
Please.
Are you happy? Are you unhappy?
I don't know. I'm happy when I'm not here. Is that bad?
Well, that's the difficulty of achieving happiness in the workplace. Mm. Dan Glertner makes the point.
I meant in Illinois, not at the station.
Oh,
by the
okay.
way.
Okay. All right. Well, it's happy to find happiness in certain states, too, I guess. That's point. But he makes the point about work, if that is the variable, if that's the source of the increase in unhappiness. Oh, by the way, work isn't supposed to be fun.
It's
work.
Yeah, but you should do what you love because then it won't be work. Damn.
Well, I get that.
You don't need me to tell you that.
I get that, but there's a first order priority with respect to work. Mm-hmm. Supporting yourself and a family. So maybe I'm not, you know, most people are not as fortunate as you are, Amy, that you get to do something that you love to do.
I get to do two things I love, working here
and
coaching. I love coaching.
So a lot of people are not so fortunate. And so they work because maybe they're not in love with their job, but they have higher priorities. Like, I need to do something to make ends meet so I can support my family. That seems to be forgotten. Glertner poses an interesting question. Why don't feminists obsess about the distribution of men versus women in the business of being a garbage collector the way they do a Fortune 500 CEO?
Oh, that's so true. Or a coal miner, or there's a lot of construction jobs.
Why?
I don't know.
Why don't they?
That's a very good question.
Well, I think it goes to this understanding of what work fundamentally is. I mean, there's abstractions to its soul craft, and I mean, it's more than just making ends meet. Even if you're not doing something that's your heart's desire, but I just that is a great illustration of the phoniness of the third wave feminist position on work. What they're saying is, I want more people with status. I want more women, or this is the same thing with any of the identitarian hustlers, race or gender identity. I want more people of status. I don't care if it makes them happy or not happy. I just want more people in those positions because what I'm really interested in is status and the power that comes with status for the movement. They're not interested in people's happiness. They're not interested in people's fulfillment. And they're not interested in people choosing to do something that they like to do and taking notice of that. They're interested in the first female assistant offensive coordinator in the NFL. Status, power, deconstruction.
As long as they're good at their job,
Not about happiness. Not about fulfillment. It's about politics. And that skews people's appreciation for basic things like the nature of work and also, frankly, the nature of family. Deborah, Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. First of all, equal pay for equal work, great. I think women bring a lot of this upon themselves, the feminists. You know, if somebody chooses to stay home and raise their family, you're treated as this pariah. What a failure you are because you're not working outside the home. You think you can have it all at once, and, you know, like, that it isn't respected, that maybe that's your choice right now. It's very hard to do both and do everything well. And then fast forward to now, men now are, like, hijacking things from women, you know, like in sports and stuff. Well, I thought, what happened to the women's movement? Where is everybody? I don't get it.
I know.
Thanks, Deborah.
Title IX fighters, where are you? Well, a lot of phone calls and text messages. 312-642-5600 if you want to jump in the conversation.
A lot of grievances. A lot of here's why I'm unhappy.
Yeah. Here's a text message. Women are unhappy because they're trying to do a man's job by themselves. I don't know about that.
Well, what's the man's job?
I don't know. They don't text me more.
I bet that person is getting at the idea of work and raise a family.
Yeah.
And then Dan Gallardner, because I think he has a good riff on this. It's not novel, but it's nicely phrased. Two incomes have become necessary, formerly one sufficed.
Yep.
So children see their parents less. Both husband and wife are exhausted at the end of the day, and then they get to split the housework, which is another complete job in and of itself, which now gets done grudgingly because it's treated as an afterthought. Each spouse now works a job and a half for a lower standard of living, and we struggle to explain why happiness is declining.
Women are unhappy because that alleged quote you just had of they split the housework, that's not true. Women do most of the housework. I think we do things that people don't even know that we're, you know, I just wanted to go on a strike one day just to let the kiddies know how much work I do at the home. We don't go home and go to sleep. You got to do the dishes, laundry, clean up, feed the animals, blah, blah, blah. The list goes on and on.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I sound like I'm complaining.
You sound like you're unhappy.
Do I?
What?
Sorry. I love doing it every day.
Oh, sounds like it. Yeah. Sounds like you're having a ball. Can I offer one thought on the topic as
please.
Well?
Yes, mm-hmm. Please.
Maybe some women aren't happy because they thought they married men, but they didn't.
That's true, too.
Jeff and Kelsey.
Never marry a man who does not have a power drill or a stud finder. Trust me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dan, do you have a power drill?
No, but I've got a couple stud finder jokes. Jeff in Cal City, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, good morning, Dan and Amy. My take is a little different. I think that this is just a liberal power grab to absolve people of their own self-responsibility. Aren't you responsible for your own happiness? They just want to enact legislation to force other people to do what they want to do. I mean, maybe they should talk to the writers of the Will Smith movie Pursuit of Happiness and review that again.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Mary Kay. Go ahead.
Text message. Congratulations, women. You finally achieved equality. You're now just as miserable as us.
Exactly.
From the Amish Dexter.
Yeah. Welcome to the party. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Yeah, I know. I'm angry because I don't have any control over my own life anymore because the government screwed it all up. And I have to work harder than I ever thought I would have to at this age. And so does my husband. And that's just not what I was expecting. I didn't think it was going to happen. I can't afford to belong to a golf club anymore. I can't. I know.
Important to you. I got it.
It is. And that's what makes me so mad. I've never felt oppressed by men. I've had all the same opportunities. I never felt that. I just don't. I mean, I haven't worked my whole life. I stayed home with my kids and I for 20 years. And now try to get a job. Try to keep up with the tech stuff. I can't do it.
Let me try to bring some happiness to your life.
You're going to sponsor Mary Kay and myself to at Olympia Fields, right?
I'm not going to sponsor you like for membership. I'm going to host you. Let's just make sure we use the right verbiage here.
Yeah, we're show up. Like, we're here because Dan Proft is sponsoring us.
Yeah,
please.
Right. I will host you too at Olympia Fields this summer, as long, Mary Kay, as you don't bring your cousin Al Cervic, because I don't want my membership to be revoked.
I really want to go play there. I've played before. It's a tough course, and I want to play. Doesn't there a creek that goes through the whole thing?
Sucks in a lot of balls.
Yeah, we'll go through the whole Olympic. We'll have a little debriefing before you guys play.
Dan, you made Mary Kay and myself happy now.
It's what I do. I make
this
women happy.
Exciting.
I think there'd be a lot of disagreement to that statement, but I digress. Ralph Rantoul.
Good morning. Has anybody missed the irony that the fact that the people who did the study, they're not even happy because they can't explain their results? They don't know. And I would say this. Amy, you're talking about a man with a stud finder.
Yeah.
Any real man knows how to use a stud finder. It's called a mirror.
Oh.
I'm not the only one with stud finder jokes. Thanks for the call, Ralph. Rick, Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. I firmly believe people are confusing happiness with boredom. Modern-day society is extremely boring. The same thing over and over and over. And how can you be happy in something that is so monotonous? Get up, go to work, go home, get ready to go to work. I mean, I tell people, you could tell me today is March 5th, Friday. I'd be like, oh, okay, because it feels the same. So I think they're confusing happiness with boredom.
It's just the drones milling about. Thanks for the call, Rick. There's some of that. Karen Beecher.
And it's like Katanje said, a woman can't define herself. And if a woman can't define herself, how can she find or define happiness?
Wow. Right. Somebody texted in, women stink.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, Dan, let's go to Hooters and virtue signal the future CEOs.
That's pretty good. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Men. We don't know what we've done.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Did you see this yesterday? This alert that came over the transom that the U.S. Capitol was being evacuated because of a, quote, probable threat in the form of an aircraft in the D.C. airspace.
Wow. No.
Which was later identified as the U.S. Army's Golden Knights doing a
parachute drop.
Parachute drop into the Nationals Park for a baseball game. And okay, well, all right, so fine.
The right hand's not talking to the left hand there?
Sort of. U.S. Capitol Police, U.S. Army. It doesn't inspire a lot of confidence in a time where confidence has, to put it mildly, been a bit shaken with respect to federal law enforcement, with respect to some extent because of things like, against the backdrop of Russia and Ukraine, we have the Pentagon rolling out their equity plan. Not to mention the intel agencies and the collection of all of the above over the last several years amid the Russian collusion hoax, amid the FBI's myriad failings, including most recently with the Whitmer kidnapping plot. Yeah, it just doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. And maybe people are a little jumpy about a probable threat to the Capitol, that being issued when you see that come across on the wire, because Fox News reported earlier this week, Border Patrol stopped 23 people on the terrorist database at the southern border in 2021. That combined with more than a million encounters with people trying to come into this country illegally in fiscal year 2022, so much the problem at the border, as I mentioned yesterday, that even Bill Galston, writing the Wall Street Journal, is calling on Biden to exercise some leadership on the issue. For more on this and other topics, we're pleased to be joined by Gerard Baker, who's an editor at large for the aforesaid Wall Street Journal. Gerard, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, nice to be with you. Thank you.
Am I being too idiosyncratic in taking note of this false alarm yesterday and putting it in some sort of larger context about confidence in federal law enforcement and federal agencies generally, and then against the backdrop of how unsafe people feel, the combination of what's happening in big city America plus what's happening at the border?
You know, I don't think you are. Actually, I saw when I immediately saw that alert come up on my phone about the Capitol being evacuated. Obviously, everybody's initial reaction is, "Oh my God, what's happening now?" And then when you learn that it was, just as you say, it was a, it was. And by the way, you could, if you look at the, so there was, I looked at some of the reporting on this last night and this morning. I mean, that Golden Knights, the U.S. Army plane that was, it was circling for a long time. You know, it was going, because I think they do, you know, prepare for a parachute drop like that. So the idea that this could go on for some time and there'd be no communication between the Capitol Police and the military, I think it is symbolic, Dan, of this, you know, very disturbing, you know, lack of coordination, lack of a sense that they really are, that they know what they're doing, you know, and it comes at the same time, you know, you talk about the problems at the border, which are really serious, and the Biden administration, you know, is now going to make that worse by lifting Title 42. And you think about all of that, and then you think about the ridiculous theater we still go through, whether it's, you know, taking off our shoes to get on planes or wearing masks, although thank God that finally seems to have been lifted this week too. And you wonder, you know, so we have to go through, the rest of us have to go through this extraordinary theater to protect ourselves against terrorist threats, or protect ourselves supposedly against the threat of a virus that is no longer really, you know, a threat to the vast majority of people. And the people who are required, whose job it is to protect us, you know, don't have the most simple efficiency, the most simple ability to actually speak to each other, to know what's going on. It is. I think it is a picture of a. I think you do paint a very good picture of a larger, you know, lack of. You help explain at least why there is this larger lack of trust in the people who are supposed to be looking after us.
I wanted to get your take on something else too. That's been an underappreciated, I think, part of the story about Russia and Ukraine. It's been some mention of it, but the IMF released a statement yesterday suggesting that the war in Ukraine really has the potential to exacerbate starvation on a global scale. Let's recall, Russia and Ukraine combined supply about 30% of the world's wheat needs. They're among the largest exporters of wheat, corn, sunflower seeds, sunflower oil. And there's real question, I mean, especially after the supply chains were broken by lockdowns during the pandemic, what this could mean for, again, global famine and the conflicts that arise when people can't feed themselves. And I don't know if the Western world is taking enough notice of the potential for civil unrest that the West ultimately gets drawn into at some level by what's happening in Ukraine.
No, again, I think you're right. Civil unrest, but also and migration patterns too. I mean, that's you know, as people are, exactly as you say, there is going to be a tremendous global food shortage as a result of this war because of the role that Russia and Ukraine between them play in global wheat supplies. So yeah, the potential for conflict, but the potential, you know, obviously for famine. And the conflict that comes with it, but also a lot of people, you know, the big story, when we think about immigration or migration generally, the thing we have to, you know, keep it always at the front of our minds is that there is a long-term trend where there are still, you know, even despite the progress that's been made in the last 30, 40 years, there are still billions of people in the world, in sort of sub-Saharan Africa, parts of Asia, parts of Latin America, who are living in extremely, extremely difficult conditions and sort of subsistence, and they are looking to move north. Essentially, they're looking to move into Europe. They're looking to move into North America. They're looking to move into different parts of Asia. And this is only going to increase that. It's only going to exacerbate that. So that long term trend that we're seeing, which is putting tremendous pressure on populations here in the United States because of the growth of immigration, also in Europe, that is going to be intensified by this global food shortage. And you're right, people are not paying attention to it.
Well, speaking of the border, I mean, we have, you know, thousands coming in every day, but a lot of them are Ukrainians, and they want to be treated differently than the other people that are coming into this country. Do you think they should be? Should they go to the front of the line?
Well, you know, it's a difficult question. They are obviously, they're suffering hugely in that country, thanks to the unprovoked aggression of Vladimir Putin. And our hearts go out to them, and we completely understand their desire to escape, at least temporarily. I think that's one thing we can hope for, is that this war will end. People, by the way, it's interesting in Europe. There's been huge migration out of Ukraine, obviously into neighboring countries, and again across Europe. And the people of Europe have actually done a remarkable job of opening their homes and their hearts to them. There is some, as the war has eased, particularly around Kyiv, in the last couple of weeks, there has been some movement back. So we can hope that those people they want to live in their own country. I mean, most of them anyway. They want to be free to live in their own country. They don't want to be forced out of their country by the aggression of Vladimir Putin. But no, I think we always look after people who are genuine refugees. And this is one of the difficult things for immigration policy, is that there are genuine refugees, people who are genuinely fleeing the prospect of being murdered. We obviously have to give those people particular priority, I think. What's the problem is, as we've had immigration to the United States in the last few years, is that you've got people claiming refugee status who aren't really refugees. They just, they're economic migrants. They want a better life, understandably. Who could blame them? But they have to get in line. There are a lot of people. Most of the world would move to the United States tomorrow if it could, because of the United States' economic prosperity, because of its freedoms, and because of the way of life here. So, and the United States is under no obligation to take all those people. I do think when you're fleeing a war zone, the U.S. has a particular, the rest of the world, we all have a particular responsibility to look after them. But we do have to distinguish those people who are genuine refugees from those who are simply seeking a better life.
Well, since, per the description here of what's happening and the implications, the ripple effects of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, was it smart for former President Trump to call for, essentially a way to figure a way to compromise and end the war in Ukraine? Is that something that we should hear? We should hear more calls of that sort. You've got to figure a way out, and maybe even behind the scenes, put pressure on Zelensky to figure out how to cut a deal if there's a deal to be cut.
No, I don't agree with that. This country is being raped at the moment by Ukraine is being raped by Russia. He's under no obligation. They've shown incredible bravery and incredible resilience in the face of that aggression, and I think, just as Britain stood against the Nazis in the Second World War, the idea that Britain should have done some sort of deal with the Nazis whereby, part of Britain maybe could have been chopped off and given to the Germans. No, I don't think that's right. I think they're fighting for not only do they have every right to continue fighting, and we have every obligation, I think, to help them fight because they are resisting such aggression. If Putin is able to get something out of this, if Putin is able to take parts of the east of the country, Crimea, if he's able to achieve what he wants, anybody who thinks that he's going to stop there is just crazy. Anybody who thinks that is going to represent his final territorial demand, shall we say, in Europe, is just kidding themselves. This is and it's a terrible. We are in a terrible moral position here because somebody put it very well. The United States is fighting for the last Ukrainian. For freedom, and that is a terrible moral position for us to be in. But I do think, we need to step up the military support to them. Because again, the other thing here is, look, if it were inevitable that Russia were just going to walk all over Ukraine, as people thought at the beginning, then I think you have to think how many Ukrainians have to die before Russia, before Russia gets its way. But it's been pretty obvious in the last 7 weeks, 8 weeks. We've learned a lot about the Russian military. We've learned how incompetent they are. They've taken incredible losses. They really weren't prepared for this. They don't have either the resources or the morale, or indeed any of the things that you need to do this. There's a real chance here. There's a real chance that Russia could be defeated in Ukraine. And
well,
as long as there is that chance, we should take it.
Well, if there is that chance, and if this is comparable to the Nazis in World War II, and if it is understood that if Putin gains even more of eastern Ukraine, if he gains those provinces in eastern Ukraine, and maybe even the Mariupol land bridge to Crimea, that he will continue, then should we be considering talking about moving in the direction of deploying American troops?
Not to Ukraine. No, I think the Biden administration very belatedly and slowly, it should have, it really is, it got this wrong from a very early stage, but it has finally started to get it right. Moving the American troops to defend NATO countries is exactly the right thing to do, and you know, beefing up the American presence in Poland, in those other sort of countries that border Ukraine and are very close to Russia, I think is the right thing to do. But I agree with the Biden administration and with the NATO countries that we don't want to get in a war with Russia over Ukraine, a direct war. If Russia does increase its aggression and expand its ambitions and its footprint into NATO countries where we have a treaty which obligates us to support those countries, then I think then so be it. Then we have to have a war with them. But I don't think we can. I don't think the necessary preparations in terms of what the American people understand about their obligations have been made towards Ukraine, because we've always said Ukraine is not a member of NATO, we don't have an obligation to defend them. And I think that it would be wrong for us then to get involved in a war for the administration to tell the American people we've got to go to war to defend Ukraine, because we've never said that. It's never been part of our America's international obligations. Defending NATO is an attack on a NATO country is an attack on all NATO countries, and we've always been clear about that. But I think it would be wrong to go to war to get into a direct shooting war with Russia over Ukraine.
Before we let you go, since you wrote about it, I've been interested. Macron and Le Pen, the initial round closer than anticipated. Is there a real chance that Macron can get deposed? And even if he doesn't, what does the competitive nature of his reelection suggest about, you know, a sort of another quasi-Brexit moment in Western Europe?
So I think he will. I think he will win. The polling suggests that he leads Le Pen in the second round by probably on average 8 to 10 points. He'll win by 55-45. But exactly as you say, Dan, that would be a much closer race than we've seen in France in a long time. Le Pen, when she ran against Macron 5 years ago, she got barely a third of the vote. It was about 2-1. So she's going to do dramatically better. Macron is going to do dramatically worse. I think it means, Dan, that we're in. You know, this idea that I think a lot of people had, especially when Macron won in 2017, because he won after Brexit and after Trump had been elected here, I think a lot of people said, oh, well, you know, this means that this populist sort of revolt around the world, this, you know, people dismissed it as extremism. It's going away, and the French have sort of reasserted the authority of the establishment. I think that is, we're going to get a sharp reminder on Sunday when we see the result that actually it isn't going away, and that people are still really frustrated with what they see as the arrogance of their elites, the way in which they're out of touch. And that was why Trump got elected in 2016. It's why Brexit happened. And this is continuing. And the problem, Dan, as you well know, and you talk a lot about this on your show, is these elites, they never, you know, they don't get the message. They don't learn. Whether it's about immigration or whether it's about this sort of woke cultural revolution that they're pushing ahead, it's not popular. People don't want it. People want border controls. They want the government to be responsive to their needs. They want a government that reflects them. And we still get these elites telling us, no, we know what's good for you. We're going to tell you what's good for you. We're going to do it. And when you so more and more you get, whether it was with Brexit, whether it was Trump, whether it's this large vote that Le Pen is going to get in France, there is this rising tide of populist pressure, and they won't listen to it. And as long as they continue to ignore it, the tensions in these countries, including this one, are going to get greater.
And the beatings will continue until morale improves, Gerard.
Exactly.
Gerard Baker, editor-at-large, Wall Street Journal. Gerard, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Off the ballot because they're carpetbaggers. Tennessee is not going to tolerate this.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jerry. Well, I mean, congressional elections are one thing. We're talking about sort of the institutional interests and the teachers unions that I suspect have more power than they should, even in a red state like Tennessee. There certainly seems to, at least the administrators and teachers that this Accuracy and Media group spoke with seem to be indicating as such. So, again, just because you're in a red state or you're a red part of a blue state doesn't mean that your school is immune from the sort of we're going to do our own thing, and our own thing is to comply with the leftist political agenda in the classroom, like you're seeing at some places in Tennessee, at least.
They just didn't think they'd get caught. You know, not nodding. Oh, yeah, sure, you passed a law, great. But we still have our agenda, and we still have our curriculum, and they're not going to change it.
Well, and also, too, I mean, they're essentially daring the authorities to do something. We're going to do what we got. We don't do anything we don't believe in. Okay. Grant in Rockford.
Good morning, you guys. Great topic. Listen, we pulled our girl out of kindergarten because of the masks, and we're debating on putting her back in. And we're just like you said, Dan, we're a red school in a blue state, but we're not going to put her back in next year. It's outrageous. We have nieces and nephews in the middle school, and there is a child that identifies as a freaking panda bear, and they accommodate this kid. It's just all, it doesn't matter about the parents. It doesn't matter about the kids. It's their social engineering, and I'll be damned if I'm going to send my kid there. Thank you.
There's a kid who's a hashtag at one of the District 214 high schools. Mm-hmm. A hashtag.
And
I don't even know what that means.
Well, let's take another call. Mark in Algonquin. Hey, Mark.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I just got on to listening to you, and this is a subject that the wife and I, this past week, after finding getting an email about the day of silence tomorrow, we've just had enough. It's when is we truly don't understand why the schools that should be focused on education are really cramming this type of ideal down our throats for what seems to be 1%. And we're just having such a difficult time because our focus is solely on education. And I just don't understand the powers to be that sway these minds of our school districts for 1% of the population. It's just, we're beyond anger at this point. And I really, I'm writing a letter to the superintendent, but how could we voice up? How could we get people to understand that this is not the general welfare of our people, like the Constitution says, you take care of the welfare of the general public, not 1%. And I just don't understand it without, is there a platform you know of that we could express our feelings?
Yeah, your local school board. Are you District 300?
We are District 300.
You remember not so long ago, David Scarpino, he's board president. He is one of the worst offenders of imperious, dismissive, insulting, ignorant conduct that we saw during the pandemic.
Oh, that's right.
When he dismissed that woman who talked about the negative impacts mask wearing was having on her kid.
Who had special needs. And what did he say?
A special needs kid.
Are you done making, trying to get on TV?
Are you done auditioning for TV? Yeah, right. Exactly. Are you done playing to the cameras?
Yeah.
That guy should be throttled, at least electorally, if not more. And so you wonder why you have what you have going on in Algonquin. And something else you said, too, I just want to seize upon. To accommodate 1%, not about accommodating 1%. It's about using 1% to impose your will on 100%. And that's what this deal is, the solidarity and marginality play of the left that is all about power politics. It has nothing to do even with the 1%. They're a means to ends. They're mascots for the new Marxists. That's what this is.
I totally agree. And with tomorrow, at this point, my wife wants to keep my kid at home. And I'm like, we're treading a fine line if the word gets out, and we're a family that helps out every type of culture. And my kids respect everyone and treat them with kindness. And that's all, our focus is the school should focus on the parents. The parents are the only ones that should express their ideals on their children. And for them to get involved at this, it's just we're a country that's turning to,
Parents, go do your thing. We'll take care of your kids. And that has to change. It's just going down a path that, you know, I'm worried we can't recover from. And I'm always a glass half full, but, you know, they get this email, and I talk to my kids about the day of silence. Guys, my kids say that all the other students, not all, but many of them, it's a joke to them. I don't know if the maturity level is there for them to understand, but bottom line, the school knows they should get the parents involved. If Johnny bullies this kid, bring the parents in, have a little bit harsher discipline, and then maybe things will change if the parents get more involved. But
yeah, and the day of silence is tomorrow. It's an annual day of action, is to spread awareness about bullying and harassment of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender.
Right. Of course,
So you take a day-long vow of silence to.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Right, this imaginary mob violence, the targeting of the LGBTQIA+, and of course their definition of violence is disagreement. Their definition of violence is you're not celebrating with us.
Right.
That is
violence. Silence is violence.
That is violence to them. I mean, it's more than a joke. It's pernicious because the people behind it are pernicious. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, do you profess to know anything about NASCAR?
I shouldn't say I don't know anything. I'm just not. I'm not a big NASCAR fan, but that's a whole subculture, and people love. I have a cousin who spends her vacations going to NASCAR.
Where is your cousin? Where does she live?
She lives in Schaumburg.
That's
unusual.
And
she just loves it. And her husband, they used to live in North Carolina.
Oh, well, there you go.
But she's from here, but they lived in North Carolina. They, you know, they got into it, and they just love it.
So they're fans of the King. Do you know who the King is?
No, I'm not going to.
North Carolina?
Oh, I watch Talladega Nights. Does that qualify?
No.
I like baby Jesus.
I'm talking about a real person. Let's just give you a hint. He surprisingly lost a campaign for Secretary of State in North Carolina. Remember that? Richard Petty.
The King?
You know who that is?
He's the King?
Uh-huh. You know who that is?
I'm going to find out in 2 seconds after I Google him.
You know who Dale Earnhardt's, you know what Dale Earnhardt's nickname was?
I know there's a Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Uh-huh. That was not his nickname, though.
Mike, Scott, help me out.
I'm not Dale Earnhardt Jr. was not his nickname.
Okay.
The Intimidator.
Oh.
And that is the extent of my NASCAR knowledge. So we whipped through that very fast. But I just say, well, I live north of the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah.
So what am I supposed to know about NASCAR? Although we do have that Joliet Speedway.
We sure do. Been out there.
So this is why I was fascinated by this piece in the American Conservative by Wells King about the what he calls the rise and fall of NASCAR. And just how it also provides commentary on American culture, particularly corporate culture. As embedded in American culture. It's a really, really good read if you don't know anything about NASCAR, or if you do. I think his sort of history in brief provides some interesting insights and provokes some good questions. Let's see if we can ask some. Wells King joins us now. He is the research director for American Compass. Wells, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned Dale Earnhardt in part because other than Richard Petty, that's the only nickname I know from the NASCAR folk. But also because in your piece, you suggest that the fortunes of NASCAR turned in a couple of different ways upon Dale Earnhardt's death when he died in that crash on the track.
Yeah, I think it's tough to understate. Or to overstate just how devastating Dale Earnhardt's death was at the 2001 Daytona 500. It was a collective trauma within the South especially, but I think especially among NASCAR fans. I remember where I was when Dale Earnhardt died. I grew up in the North Carolina Piedmont, was raised by NASCAR fans. But what's remarkable is the extent to which NASCAR, driven by the imperatives to compete with other leagues like the NFL and Major League Baseball, to make its cars more safe, to prevent deaths like Dale Earnhardt's, to make itself more culturally mainstream, and ultimately to make itself less distinctively Southern, not only transformed the sport of NASCAR, but betrayed its fan base, who were understandably crazy about Dale Earnhardt Sr. and what he represented, which was this kind of hard scrabble, working class Southern mentality that was manly and aggressive and took risks and sought honor on the track.
Sorry to interrupt, but explain that a little bit too. I mean, I think you were getting at it, which is you can have that appeal, that working class appeal, but also make the cars safer. Why was that problematic for fans?
Well, the issue with this particular car, so they invest millions of dollars into building what they call the car of tomorrow. And the changes that they make to these cars are minute, right? They're moving the seats by inches. They're expanding the width of the car by a few inches. But what changes with the car of tomorrow and fundamentally kind of changes the sport are a few things. One is it becomes what's known as essentially a spec car, where the specifications of the car are centrally mandated and enforced by NASCAR for all manufacturers. So all manufacturers that create NASCARs are set to the same exacting set of standards. So there's no manufacturer differentiation anymore. It's just the facade of the car that looks different. And then they enforce these cars rigorously with this contraption known as the claw, which fit over each of the cars and use the laser inspection device to measure it down to the thousandth of an inch to ensure adherence to these rules. NASCAR teams were notorious for cheating in the past, for tinkering with engines, for tinkering with the aerodynamics of their cars to kind of skirt some of the rules and regulations that NASCAR had set up, but not anymore with the car of tomorrow. So it really fundamentally changed the way that teams approached cars and racing and driving and the construction of them, but also what it meant for you to, say, be driving in a Monte Carlo or in a Ford. It changed the sport, and fans and drivers were incensed about it.
And so other changes to the sport, particularly I'm interested in the corporatization of NASCAR. You mentioned NASCAR wanted to go more mainstream to compete with the other professional sports leagues, also because that's where the big corporate cash is, like the track they built in Joliet in Chicagoland, yep. You know, has the luxury boxes like you would see at other sports stadiums and so forth. And so, I think that I sort of get what's happening to NASCAR, like what happened to being a Bears, you know, going to a Bears game or a Bulls game where it's unaffordable for middle-income families.
Yeah, no. So there's this really deliberate campaign beginning in the 1990s as NASCAR is really picking up steam and rising in popularity. And in some places, it's overtaken the NHL and MLB in terms of the popularity and viewership, and it's poised to really become one of the major sports of the United States at this point in time. The issue is that it was so regionally concentrated within the Southeast. You know, 90% of its races in the 60s were in the South. And so there's this deliberate campaign to enter new markets. And so they build stadiums and speedways in Los Angeles, in South Florida, in Miami, in Vegas, in Chicagoland. And what's important about these tracks is not just their location, but they're also tend to be what were directly referred to as cookie cutter tracks. They're 1.5 mile long ovals. So they aren't the big, long super speedways. And they aren't the small regional tracks that encourage sort of tighter, more dangerous, and more tightly packed racing. And so the product was just inferior. but these were also souped up luxury stadiums. They really did kind of resemble sort of the blue chip NFL stadiums. So they're, of course, less affordable, but also really are such a radical departure from the origins of the sport, which were on these regional, originally dirt ovals within especially the Carolina Piedmont.
And so you have this homogenization of the sport because that's the trade-off for corporate culture. And you also have the loss of personality. I mean, we've seen that on PGA Tour. You see that in all sorts of sports. Mm-hmm. So gone are – I mean, the most exciting thing to happen in NASCAR for the passive observer was an embarrassing thing, and that was Bubba Wallace turning a garage door pull down into a noose. I mean, that's the last thing I remember that happened in NASCAR because, sorry, I'm not really that compelled by Jeff Gordon or Jimmy Johnson.
Right. Well, I mean, like, so beginning in the mid-2000s, you have NASCAR releasing diversity statements and launching diversity programs. You have, you know, the manufactured rise of Danica Patrick. This is sort of during the era of lost feminism.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in 2020, with the BLM riots, you know, you have a Black Lives Matter car being driven by Bubba Wallace. And then the noose hoax, which, you know, every fan knew what this, you know, alleged hate crime was. But they still had to call in the FBI to say, no, in fact, it's just a pull rope for the garage door.
Did the Bubba Wallace incident, or whatever you want to call it, did that help or hurt NASCAR?
And you know, it's tough. It's tough to say because NASCAR was already so hurt at that point in time. I mean, the viewership was already way down. At that point, Talladega had the Daytona 500 had already had its lowest viewership in years. Viewership was way down. And I think, if anything, it was just yet another sort of kick in the pants for NASCAR fans. So this was yet another attempt to brandish them as racist and to kind of bring some kind of mainstream appeal to the sport by saying, no, don't worry about our redneck past. We're woke now, and we're trying to root out our problems in our sport.
The story of NASCAR sort of reminds me of the Illinois Republican Party, which is reminiscent of the National Republican Party in fits and starts over the years, which is we're going to jettison the fans that we have in order to try and get fans we can't get, which is sort of what Republican – we're going to jettison the voters we have in order to try to get voters we can't get.
Right, exactly. We are going to water down our product and become something that we're never really truly going to be. And by the way, betray our most loyal supporters in an effort to reach out to those who have deeper pockets and are in more lucrative markets. Oh, and by the way, this type of approach will make us rich. It really was the self-interest of executives at NASCAR, the suits, as I call them in my piece, who were attempting to transform this sport, motivated by their own self-interest and trying to juice the fortunes of NASCAR. And in doing so, not only did they betray their fan base, but the fans began to leave the sport. The viewership of NASCAR has been in decline for years, and the sport was changed and I think irreparably damaged. We'll see. The sport is making some changes recently. I think it's learning some of the errors of its ways. Viewership is up this year, which is encouraging, and they're returning to some dirt tracks, and there's some exciting young drivers, but still the damage is done, and I'm not sure that it'll ever be what it was in the 80s and 90s.
Why do you love NASCAR? Besides, you know,
I grew up in Concord, North Carolina, which is the town next over from where Dale Earnhardt Sr. was born and raised, and so it was just kind of in the air we breathed. You know, a lot of the NASCAR teams are based there. One of the biggest races of the year, the Coca-Cola 600, is held there. So I grew up going to races, but like a lot of NASCAR fans, my father and our family friends really stopped watching in the years after Dale's death. It's been a decade since I've been to a race. I was outraged by the types of changes that they did between the Car of Tomorrow and adding the chase and the playoff and all of these changes that really seemed to undermine and undercut the real spirit and ethos of the sport that drew people like my father and his friends and drew me as a kid to this sport when I was young. So I hope that NASCAR is able to get back to its roots, that it decides not to betray its fan base and instead to actually to return to its roots and deliver a product that they want. When they do that, I would love to go back to races. But for the time being, I'm out.
Wells King, research director at American Compass. Check out his piece, The Decline and Fall of NASCAR, at theamericanconservative.com. Wells, thanks so much for joining us. Fun discussion. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, Amy, I'm reading this permission slip you got from Allman Brothers High School, and you sort of buried the lead when you were describing it earlier.
I did. Well, now, because, you know, they've gone over. It's the senior diploma. It's IBDP, and the class is Theory of Knowledge. Uh-huh. And they've broken down Plato's allegory of the cave, and now they're going to explore a more contemporary field of thought, intersexual feminism. So in this mini unit, they're going to be analyzing systems of oppression as they pertain to identity, gender, sexuality, and the expression of self. As a centralizing mentor text to the unit, we will watch and discuss Jeannie Livingston's 1990 documentary, Paris is Burning. And that documents, you know, the daily lives of trans people of color living in New York City in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the film explores the communities formed in the face of oppression, the violence faced by many, and the hopes and aspirations of those living in the 20th century American society.
Sure. It's the feel-good class of this semester. No, I get it. I wonder what perspective the teacher will direct the kids to adopt.
I watched the trailer, and it's sad. It shows, you know, how they were abandoned by their parents, a lot of them, because of, you know, they're either gay or transsexual. But it also exploits, I think, the mental illness aspect, too, of this. So that's why I signed this permission slip.
It exploits or explains?
No, I said explores.
Does it?
I watched the trailer. I watched a few different trailers of it. So
yeah, I have a hard time believing that there's going to be an even-handed treatment of that issue. Just like I have a hard time believing that there'll be any even-handed discussion on the topic when it comes to the public health piece of it. Although the state of Florida, and under Governor DeSantis, it's doing its best. They just put out a missive, the Department of Public Health in Florida, on the treatment of gender dysphoria for children and adolescents in contravention to the rules being recommended by the D.C. ruling class and the White House specifically. It's noting here something that probably no one knows, but systematic reviews on hormonal treatment for young people show a trend of low-quality evidence, small sample sizes, and medium to high risk of bias. A paper published in the International Review of Psychiatry states that 80% of those seeking clinical care will lose their desire to identify with the non-birth sex. 80%, 4 in 5, will lose their desire to identify with the non-birth sex. But everything we hear is you are to adopt whatever position your child takes at any point in time and begin mutilating him or her post-haste if you want to be an ally of the trans community. Huh. Interesting. You know, for that class, maybe I'll send Peyton and Eli some of Camille Paglia's writings on the topic, see if that would be open to the teacher. The teacher would be open to discussing that. For example, when she writes, I'm a woman who loves women. I also love men, and I think feminists could benefit from giving up the witch hunt against men. I love all things gay related, but that doesn't mean I'm for switching genders. And parenthetically, I also have a beef against what I call gay Stalinists. That is, people who turn queerness into an axe to grind, thereby becoming as dogmatic as the homophobes. And and that's, of course, the same thing with trans. I mean, it's all the LGBTQIA plus continuum. She goes on to talk about how horrified she was by Chastity Bono's sex change back. This is a few years old now. Camille Paglia, the author of Sexual Personae, an accomplished academic, a radical feminist, a lesbian, Wonder how that would be received by the class there for Peyton and Eli. Maybe they could throw that in there and mix it up a little bit. Wouldn't that be fun?
It would be.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll suggest it.
You should. I'll send along as much material as they'd like to present. For more on the mixing it up, we're pleased to be joined by Paul Kanger, professor of poli-sci at Grove City College in Grove City, PA, contributor to the American Spectator, author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration. Paul, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, hey, Dan, Amy, and remember, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go.
No, I recall.
So, you know, yeah. Push to get no more Shakespeare, no more Austin, no more Dante. You know, make room for queer studies.
Well, there's no question about it. And, how does that happen? Well, one of the ways it happens is you elect a Marxist lesbian to be the president of the American Library Association. That just happened. Emily Drabinsky is her name, her tweet. I just cannot believe that a Marxist lesbian who believes that collective power is possible to build and can be wielded for a better world is the president-elect of the American Library Association. I'm so excited for what we will do together. Solidarity! Exclamation point. Yeah.
She's got all the words there, doesn't she? Solidarity, collective power.
Marxist,
and, you know,
lesbian.
Yeah. She's a classic, what they call gender Marxist. And, you know, we've talked about this before, that the Marxists today, you know, they're not talking about, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie and redistributing wealth according to class and the factory and the farm and that sort of thing. No, they're doing race, gender, and sexual orientation. So it's all about, as Antonio Gramsci and the Frankfurt School and those people put it, culture, 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 and sex, sex, sex. That's their new revolution. And putting somebody like that at the Library Association, that's a major victory forward, right, for the cultural revolutionary.
But I transphobes and homophobes and people who suffer from all the phobias. And all of the isms, right? Practitioners of all of the isms, sufferers of all the phobias. We're just making this stuff up, which is why I was surprised to read this story. Maryland School Board to adopt new flag policy. This is Carroll County, Maryland. After teachers said they were being bullied into supporting the LGBTQ pride flag. And the school board president saying, you know, forcing teachers to fly the flag is not inclusive. So I'm surprised. I thought I was just making this up. I thought this was just stuff coming from my head. It's not real.
Well, you know, if you go to a lot of smaller university towns, and I was in one in central PA about 3 weeks ago, and I talked to my host about it. He's one of the only conservatives on the faculty of about 300 faculty, right? So he said you can count on one hand the number of conservatives, and they're kind of all in hiding. And he told me how basically the month of June and into the 4th of July has become almost intolerable in his little town, because the whole place is just festooned with rainbow flags and no American flags at all. And by the time July 4th comes out, you know, they don't have American flags up. They still have their LGBTQ flags. And I was at another town, actually in Maryland, a college town. My wife and I used to go there, going back to the time we lived in Washington, D.C. in the early 1990s. Same thing. And it becomes, in fact, I remember my wife saying, you know, that not only there's probably some level of intimidation here, where if you don't get your flag up, you're going to be in trouble. And I could tell you, too, Dan, they were in all the storefronts.
Of course.
And that you just know that the stores, if they don't put that flag up, man, they're going to be in trouble. They're going to get boycotted by the diversity. And
it'll be a modern day Kristallnacht there if they don't put the flags up. I know we're just making this stuff up and we're just transphobes and so forth. But again, this is weird. I know there's no need for parental rights legislation like in Florida. But then I see this story out of Ludlow, Massachusetts, parents filing a suit against a school district alleging the administrators at a middle school secretly promoted the gender transitions of two students against the wishes of their parents. So then I think, gosh, maybe Ron DeSantis is onto something.
Yeah, you know, when I was in school back in the the medieval period, right, in the 1980s, I mean, you needed to get parents' permission to get an aspirin from the school nurse, right? And you know, of course, now ever since then, liberals have been fighting for you don't even need the parents' permission if you want to have an abortion, and you know, to do something like try to quote unquote change your biological sex. I mean, I don't know how you go from somebody whose body is filled with XX chromosomes and not a single Y among trillions of them can suddenly become a boy, right? This is enormously damaging. I find this ironic too, Dan and Amy. We're in this whole kind of period, especially among the sort of hippie left, and not just them. I mean, my wife and I do this as well. You know, you're really into organic and all natural stuff and really careful about what you take and what you put into your body. And here all of a sudden, you know, they're doing something as wild and extreme as cutting off their genitalia and going through these massive hormone treatments, and as well as forcing everybody to take experimental COVID vaccines on top of that. You know, so the left can be kind of all pure, all organic, all hippie commune, you know, grow natural, dude, right? And then all of a sudden, here they are going as unnatural as you could possibly imagine. And no one can even object to it without being some type of a phobe.
Well, it used to be you'd have to have a year of counseling before they would do any type of, you know, dismemberment or mutilation of your body. But now, you know, there's a lot of girls who feel like tomboys, and there's a lot of girls who don't want to go through puberty. And then when they go through puberty, they don't want to have that monthly visitor. So, yeah, they want to become a boy. But we need to get that back, where I think that you still have to have a year of counseling, or at least, you know, something. Don't you agree? I mean, and I just don't know how to go about it, because now you have these hospitals that are making money off of gender reassignment surgery.
Right. And especially for somebody, Amy, who's, you know, under 10 years old or under, frankly, under 18. I talked to my sister about this recently. She was a tomboy, total tomboy, you know, in a family with two brothers who were athletes. And you know, she says, you know, thank God that I didn't grow up in the 2020s. Who knows what they might have been trying to talk me into trying to change. So yeah, the idea, and you know, I have 8 kids, and you know, they're not sexually intrigued or interested until they hit about 12 or 13. You know, if people listening know this, you know, they don't start showing, you know, the literal physical manifestations of sexual maturity, I don't need to go into detail, until they're about 12, 13, 14 years old. So the idea that you would be doing this to 7, 8-year-olds is absolute madness. And I'm not going to shirk from saying it, and nobody else should. This is crazy. And I think reasonable liberals understand it, too. They're afraid to say it. You know, look at all the parents whose daughters are getting whipped in swim meets by this male at the University of Pennsylvania, Leah Thomas. And they're all afraid to speak out about it. Most of them are liberals. They're afraid that their daughters are going to get canceled. They're going to get canceled. It's crazy. People need to have some courage, right? C.S. Lewis, how about some men with chests?
Yes,
people need
indeed to
stand up.
Well, how about some men with wombs? Paul, I've got a homework assignment for you, since you don't seem to be hip to the cultural zeitgeist. Netflix new series opening today, posting today, He's Expecting. And the cover of the series features a woman hugging her husband from behind with his shirt open in front that shows his pregnant womb. He's Expecting.
Wow.
So you wonder why Netflix is hemorrhaging subscribers. Yeah.
Right. And I have to ask this very basic question. Is the he actually a she biologically?
You know, you're going to have to watch the series to find out. I'm sure there'll be a lot of twists and turns.
It's a really dramatic twist and turns.
And I'm not going to tell you how the crying game ends either, because I don't want to spoil that.
No, this is a series that is kind of violating everything from, biblical law to natural law and basic biology. You know, when I was in school, we called this stuff the birds and the bees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, girls have eggs, you know, men have sperm.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way that, you know, this is how reproduction occurs. He's expecting. I hope the whole thing is in quotations.
Professor Paul Kanger, Professor Poli Sci, Grove City College in Grove City, PA, contributing American Spectator, author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration. Thanks as always, Paul.
Hey, thanks. Hang in there, you guys.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.